are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 6, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Bureau Chief Correspondent of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, will be here on the Dead Enders. Candidates who signed up to battle Donald Trump must get past the Democratic Party first. Meanwhile, the stock market in turmoil. But why are we supposed to care? Polish president signed a mandatory Holocaust denial bill.
Innovation.
Mick Mulvaney to drop Equifax investigation. Kellyanne Conway making the opioid cabinet expert free. And a desperate Pennsylvania Republican Party looking to impeach five members of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the last 3 days, ladies and gentlemen, have seen the largest elimination of protected areas in U.S. history. Congratulations to me. Corn syrup lobbyist is holding the pen in the rewriting of the USDA dietary guidelines. Marco Rubio and Ivanka Trump hatch a paid leave, rob Social Security scam. And we are 2 days from the deadline. The House votes to punt the government shutdown, but the Senate not yet on board. And lastly, Donald Trump's lawyers don't want him to testify because no shit. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, folks, I interviewed Ryan Grimm about this piece on Ring of Fire. I think it was last week. Maybe it was a week before. I cannot remember. It's a really important piece, and so I think you're going to enjoy this. And in some ways, it is more of a systems critique than it is an ideological argument. But we will talk to him about that. And meanwhile, I don't know. It changes every 5 minutes, but apparently the stock market is a little volatile these days, and I still can't quite figure out why we're supposed to care.
The idea that it upsets Trump emotionally.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. There is always an added bonus if it makes him feel slightly uncomfortable about anything. That is a very good reason to care.
I do have somewhat of a stake in it because of my husband's pension.
Of course.
Assuming we're together for that long.
But here's
that was a Mason joke, style. Folks. Was a joke.
But here's the point. You're not going to be touching that pension for 30 some odd years. And basically the stock market is back to where it was in December. Frankly, it doesn't, like I say, if you're getting your pension next week, you're still better off than you were last June. But the fact of the matter is that 50% of stocks are owned by a small fraction of the American public. Yes, there are pensions, but like I say, you day-to-day fluctuations in the market, month-to-month fluctuations in the market, and particularly of this size, it is just an example of how narrowly focused our media is on specific issues. I find it sort of fascinating and hilarious in some respects. We won't talk anymore about that because I don't really care. I mean, unless we see direct evidence of Donald Trump feeling uncomfortable in some fashion, I'm done.
Unless I can contribute to sort of lack of faith in the market personally, I don't want to talk about it.
I mean, you made a good point the other day about the stock market, I think.
Which was
how they have the stocks running along the bottom of every news program. And for most people, that's like getting news from another planet or something.
I mean, honestly, it's been like this for forever.
I remember being a kid and watching it when I was like 8 and watching CNBC and being like, oh my God, all the arrows are green, and thinking it was like awesome.
See, it actually does matter to normal people.
There you go. I like green arrows. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Donald Trump seems to be getting increasingly nervous. There was actually a story, and you know, all of this, like, Robert Mueller looks like he's investigating this, Robert Mueller looks like he's investigating that stories. I feel like there's not a month that has gone by where you don't see a story of, like, Robert Mueller's investigation is further along than you think, and the pace is picking up. I feel like that is a headline we see everywhere. There is a story, I think it was in New York Magazine or Wired. That one was in Wired. But there was another one that suggested Mueller is looking into the targeting of voters in Wisconsin and Michigan by Russian Facebook bots and possible communications between the Trump campaign that would have sent voter file data, because it's highly unlikely that it's one thing to try and mess with an election. You'd have to be fairly sophisticated to know, well, you couldn't without having the voter data files of, you know, the certain counties that you would want to geo-target with your ads. Nevertheless, apparently Mueller is looking into that type of collusion. I mean, that's one of the things that we did talk about way back when. And I still would argue that to the extent that anyone on the Trump campaign sent that type of targeting information to the Russians, they did so thinking they were talking to the same guys who steal credit card numbers for their buddies, who could very well be the same people, frankly. But I don't know that the, you know, officials in the Trump administration would have to know that they were colluding with Russian national operatives as opposed to just, you know, the Serbian hires of Russian mafiosa guys. Like, we thought we were dealing with the mafia. We had no idea. But nevertheless, that is a roundabout way to go to say that Donald Trump clearly has treason on his mind. He's a little bit nervous. And one of the things that I think is sort of a standard practice in the context of political campaigns, particularly as operated by the Republicans, is projection, right? I mean, we know back in 2004, George W. Bush had been exposed more or less that he had gone AWOL from his military service. So they made John Kerry's military service, where he actually went to Vietnam, the issue. Well, here's Donald Trump, very, very concerned about reasons to believe that perhaps the Democrats are treasonous.
Didn't even want to look too much during the speech over to that side, because honestly, it was bad energy.
Pause it for 1 second. Now, of course, Donald Trump is talking. Go back to the beginning. Donald Trump is talking about the State of the Union address.
I think Michael is offended by this gross cultural appropriation of his people.
Exactly. You don't use my woo language, you bastard.
I didn't like the I didn't have my proper, crystals.
My chakras weren't energetically aligned.
What's amazing?
I needed to guard my,
I think he went back and watched his speech and realized that he only looked at one teleprompter and never went back. And so now he's trying to sort of reverse engineer an excuse for it. But here we go.
I didn't even want to look too much during the speech over to that side because honestly, it was bad energy.
Yeah.
No, it was bad energy. You're up there. You've got half the room going totally crazy, wild. They loved everything. They want to do something great for our country. And you have the other side, even on positive news, really positive news like that, they were like death and un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to love our country very much.
He's back in form. You know what? He has had such a drought recently. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I don't know. Somebody said treasonous. I don't know. The old classic.
I love that.
The way he uses that, it could be somebody in the crowd, or it could be he heard just somebody, like maybe his son or something, say
or treasonous. Maybe he just was sitting around in bed last night going like, it's treasonous, but I can't say that. I can say somebody else said that.
Exactly.
I mean, that's his whole shtick, right? I mean, he would retweet
somebody
gave
me another Big Mac.
It was a retweet.
So there it is.
I'll say somebody said it. Maybe
let's start the show trials.
The same
didn't applaud.
Maybe the same friend that went to Paris said treasonous.
Bad energy.
You can't go anywhere.
Here are the charges. Bad energy.
Bad energy.
Didn't applaud.
A total lack of energetic alignment.
I couldn't even look over to them. That's a charge.
Total
treason.
Not manifesting espionage. Co-creator. So espionage.
Highest ratings of any show trials in history, folks.
Let's.
That
all
would be actually.
Do we have time for this? I think we do. Do we have a Paul Ryan's? Yesterday, we showed Paul Ryan's tweet that he pulled down. Yes. Here it is. Paul Ryan said, a secretary at a public high school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, said she was pleasantly surprised. Her pay went up $1.50 a week. She said that will more than cover her Costco membership for the year. And look, of course, if you give me an option between do you want $1.50 more or $1.50 less, I would always say more. But that same secretary, apparently was aware of that that tweet, and she has now been interviewed. She was a Pennsylvania high school secretary, and here's what she had to say on CBS News via, I guess, or maybe they just played her Facebook live stream. Here it is.
I'm really surprised, actually, because the paragraph above me, my quote, and the paragraph below my quote, those folks got hundreds more, hundreds, and I get $1.50 per paycheck more. So it shows me that he might not have read the whole article.
Yeah. Does that remind you of, it reminds me of Paul Ryan's story about the boy taking the brown bag at school.
It's just what I was
lunch. Saying.
We just need to amass these examples and play them over and over any time anyone tries to say he's like a master tactician / policy wonk.
There's so many of those. I feel like we could string together like a year's worth of both of the claims that he's a master tactician and the obvious evidence debunking the fact. But
super bad energy there.
Super bad energy. Treason. Treason. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ryan Grimm.
You
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. The Intercept's D.C. Bureau Chief Ryan Grimm. Hello, Ryan. Welcome back to the program.
Always good to be here.
Ryan, you and Li Fong had a big piece. It was about 2 weeks ago now. And I know we did talk about it on Ring of Fire, but wanted to talk a little bit more, not just about the piece itself, but sort of, I don't know, the broader implications of something like this. But you did a bit. Well, just give us a sense of like what the reporting here was involved in this.
So, I mean, part of it was easy. It just took a lot of time.
I'm sorry. Ryan, did you switch to a speakerphone?
Hold on.
Sorry. Here we go, folks.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's so much better, buddy.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
I mean, part of it was, this was not difficult to do. It just took a long time. But all of this is happening very much out in the open. It was just connecting a bunch of dots from district to district around the country. The DCCC has been, helpful in the sense that they've, in 18 races so far, they've actually publicly endorsed the candidate. So you don't have to, read the tea leaves or, look at the debate schedule, or have access to some, secret contract written between a campaign and a party organization to try to piece together which candidate is getting the support of the party, because they're publicly announcing it. And in other races, they make it clear as well by having by one candidate gets all of the Democrats in the congressional delegation plus the governor to endorse them, for instance. You look around the country and you see this happening, and that would be one thing if there was only one Democrat in the race and they're all rallying behind him or her to then beat the Republican in the general election. But then you look closer and you see that there are actual challengers to them who have full staffs, who have thousands of volunteers behind them, who have thousands of small donations that are coming in, giving them war chests that are in some cases actually greater than the centrist candidate that the party is getting behind.
All right. So, I mean, let's also just make it clear. When we say the DCCC, we're talking about tell us who the DCCC is relative to, say, let's say the DNC or the Senate version of the DCCC, just so we get a sense of like what entity we're talking about.
That's the House campaign arm. So their only job is to recruit House candidates, help them fundraise, help them train, help them with media resources, and set strategy for the midterm campaign. And it's run by Nancy Pelosi, actually, there was a revolt in the caucus, Democratic caucus, this year. So the party insisted on being able to elect the chair of the DCCC, but only one person ran, and it was Ben Ray Lujan, Pelosi's pick. So for all intents and purposes, she's still picked ahead of it. But in greater intents, like she does a lot of the fundraising for it, and she calls the shots. So this is her organization, it responsible for bringing Democrats back into the majority.
And all right, so traditionally, has the deep what is the relationship between the DCCC and the DNC? What is the relationship there?
I mean, they're buddies. The DNC its job is supposed to be to build up the state parties and then run the presidential campaign. The DSCC, that's the Senate arm, their job is to elect Senate candidates, and then the DTRIP is their job is to do the House. Now, all of them are wings of the party, and they work together. So you'll have situations where the party collectively decides that there should be more resources moved into X Senate race. And so money will flow that way, or these four House races are more important, so money can flow in that direction. So, you know, during the off years, the DNC is supposed to be more important in raising money and building up the state parties, and then during the election years, the DCCC and DSCC, they lean in on the individual races, and now they all have super PACs that are kind of aligned with them. The DCCC has what's called the House Majority PAC, which is a kind of an independent super PAC that doesn't coordinate with candidates, but it looks at races and can pump, you know, several million dollars, you know, in the final weeks or whenever they want into a race.
Okay. And so how long has it been that the DCCC, and has it always been the practice for them to intervene in primaries? And we should say that I haven't seen the statistic. I just sort of it's my assumption that we are looking at perhaps the most contested. There's probably more Democratic primary candidates for the House in an off-year election than we've probably seen, I would imagine, in our lifetime. I mean, is that yeah. accurate? Is that true?
It might even be ever, but certainly in modern memory, and so much of it is coming from the energy against Donald Trump, the anger at Trump, this like post-election epiphany that so many people had around the country that it was time to, you know, get off the sidelines and get in. And you know, it was epitomized by Barack Obama in his farewell speech, where he said, you know, if you're upset, you know, get a clipboard and run for office. And, you know, thousands of people have taken that up, and you're seeing them run in, you know, city council races, county commissioner races, all the way up to, you know, House and Senate.
So how long has the DCCC been in the business of intervening in primaries, or is it something that is sort of ad hoc, depending on the year, depending on their resources?
It's more ad hoc because, like you said, oftentimes their bigger challenge was just finding a good candidate.
Right.
You know, recruiting somebody who was going to run a credible, you know, well-financed and, you know, potentially winnable race. It's unusual for them to have situations where there are so many candidates who, you know, just objectively, all have a credible chance of winning. And so, you know, in general, their response to that has been odd. It's been to say, okay, well, then this is our person. And oftentimes they're siding with people who had run in the past, who they know, after the party has, you know, spent so much airtime, you know, encouraging new people to get in. But it's something that, you know, has precedent, and there's a logic behind it. You know, if you are a party and you feel like there is somebody running, you know, who could embarrass the party in the general election, but might be able to squeak through a primary, and they're going to get routed by the Republican. If that's your sincere belief, then there's a reason. There's a reason for you to go in and endorse. And the second reason would be if you think that the challengers aren't serious, that there's no way that these challengers ever are going to win the primary anyway, then you just go ahead and go in and say, look, we need to endorse this candidate X because she's going to win the primary and she's going to be the general election candidate. So we can't wait around until June or August to start helping her because our goal is to beat the Republican in November. And so I think in some of the cases, the party just misunderstood the field and thought that some of these people weren't really going to have serious challengers. And so they weren't intentionally trying to pick a fight with a credible challenger. It's just, they didn't, their vision just field didn't include them. In other cases, they just have candidates that they prefer for a variety of reasons.
All right. So in the first instance, you don't want from the perspective of the party. And this is also, I mean, there's an assumption here, too, that I want to question in a moment. But In the first instance, you don't want a Christine O'Donnell situation where your candidate, and she was in a Senate race, but your candidate's, you know, platform is I'm not a witch, and you don't want that person to be the candidate. In the second instance, you're just it's basic resource conservation, right? Like, we have a limited amount of resources. We got a good candidate. Let's try and drive everybody out of the primary so there isn't a primary that's going to suck any resources out. And we should say that because this is not a problem that the DCCC has faced a lot in its history, there's probably not a lot of institutional expertise at intervening on the primary level. And with that said, let me also just add that the way they intervene on the primary level is probably also indicative of the way that they intervene on the general election level. So that tells us something there. I want to just also table the assumption that the DCCC is functioning. And it's the same assumption, I think, that people make this mistake when you look at, like, corporations. Like, there's this presumption that people in a corporation are acting in the best interest of a corporation, or know what that is, as opposed to acting in their own best interests. And I want to circle back to that. But let's talk about a specific example in Minnesota. Angie Craig versus Jeff Erdemann. This is happening now. Tell us about that race.
Right. And the primary is sort of starting today. Minnesota has a very complicated three-step primary process. It involves getting delegates involved in caucuses and then this, and then, you know, but so it begins now. But the race is an interesting one. In 2016, the party got behind a candidate named Angie Craig, who's an executive at a medical device company in Minnesota, who moved to that district fairly recently. She raised something like $5 million in 2016, which the DCCC celebrates. That's a huge amount of money to raise in a race like that. It goes towards consultants who help run that race, and then millions of dollars on TV ads to pummel the Republican in the hopes of winning. She ended up underperforming everybody on the ballot. She did worse than Hillary Clinton. She did worse than the state House candidates in that district. She did worse than the state Senate candidates in that district. There was a third party, an Independence Party candidate, who peeled off about 30,000 votes, which would have been the difference if somehow she managed to win every single one of those. It was a well-run race from the perspective of Washington. Raised the right amount of money, ran the right kind of ads, ran the right kind of campaign, but it performed badly. So she's running again in 2018, and this time a guy who had volunteered on her campaign, who's a football coach and a American government teacher in Minnesota, lived in Minnesota his whole life, decided to run. He was one of these people who was inspired by the women's march and the energy against Trump to finally say, I'm gonna get off the sidelines. But the difference is huge. Craig has millions of dollars at her fingertips to run a campaign. Erdman, he went down to 80% time as a teacher, so he could keep health insurance but have time to run. His wife took on a second job, so they could, get by with his reduced income. And he just has not been able to raise the money. So this is one of those cases where, in some of the cases around the country, the progressive candidate did manage to outraise the kind of party-backed candidate. In this case, he never caught on. And part of it is that there are so many of these candidates around the country that the groups, the small dollar groups who are looking to help them, almost can't keep up. There's just too much to do. And
so when we say small, let me just, when we say small dollar groups, we're talking like Justice Democrats or People's House Project or ad hoc.
Our Revolution.
Our Revolution or ad hoc groups in, I don't know, in Brooklyn. I mean, et cetera, et cetera. So,
right.
But wait, let me just ask this about Angie Craig. I mean, through your reporting, you have $5 million. You underperform everyone on the ballot. How is that possible? Like, how bad of a candidate do you have to be? I'm not saying that facetiously. Like, that's pretty.
Yeah.
And the there's two things that pop out for me. One is, how bad of a candidate do you have to be? Two, like, how much medical devices are coming out of Minnesota? Because I know that was one of the things that Franken was really bad on, too, was trying to get that tax repealed. So a lot. Okay, so
that's the industry there. That's like their big industry.
Well, how bad of a candidate do you have to be? Like, what was she doing that was turning off so many voters? Because clearly she was able to get her message out. It was just that, like, her message or her was rejected, like, solidly.
Well, so she ran the kind of party playbook strategy, which is, you run against bad things, like you're against bigotry, you're against racism. She's lesbian, so she's for LGBT rights. She's pro-choice, but you don't really talk much about Wall Street. You don't talk about Medicare for all. You're not saying you're going to do free, public college. You just kind of are for good things and against bad things. And that may have helped create the opening for, this third party candidate to pick up the, X number of votes. It didn't inspire kind of a grassroots, army to go out and say we should be supporting this person. And people don't talk much about Minnesota because Clinton ended up winning it, but it was razor thin. I mean, it was what, 10,000 votes or so,
right.
And it almost fell to Trump. So this was not a good year for Democrats in Minnesota, even though she ended up eking it out in the end.
So the DCCC comes in and they're just like, yes. What's the theory? If we raise even more money, she'll be better this time, or she's learned a lesson, or what?
Well, I actually think there's a pretty good chance she doesn't. Let's say she wins the primary. I think there's a decent chance she does win, just for this reason that it's going to be a more Democratic year probably than
right.
It was in 2016. This time that third party candidate is not running and is running for Senate, which actually could end up coming back to bite them because they have two Senate races since they pushed Franken out. They have two Senate races on the ballot and they have a third party. So that's a separate issue. So without the third party candidate with more energy, then you may just on a sheer numbers game, put her over the top. But it goes back to the question of, well, what kind of party are you trying to become? Like you could have put Erdman, I'm sure, on that ballot line as well, and he could have won on, he supports Medicare for all, he supports he supports the whole kind of the Bernie list of policies. So you're going to send a Democrat to Congress from that district probably this cycle, but the party's choosing the medical device executive who just a couple years ago was directing a corporate PAC that was funding Republicans, actually.
Do you think, and obviously people should read into the details, and I want to ask you about some other specific races, but what I'm really interested in asking you about is, like, is it your sense that this is, that these people at the DCCC, I mean, the stuff that resonated for me, it was actually Zephyr Teachout's comments, and maybe I'm conflating what she said on Twitter about the piece or within the piece, but her basic argument was like, look, the DCCC does not have the resources to make a determination as to what's going on in these primary races. And there's a quality of this that, like, reminds me of, frankly, of my experience in writing sitcoms. You've got a bunch of people who are development executives
They don't know how to make a hit show. Nobody does. It's really, right. You just don't know. There's just too many factors. So they put their emphasis, the most important aspect of the process becomes the only one that they can intervene in any way. So in sitcoms, you got into this very sort of stale writing type of situation where you didn't need to write it as tightly as it did, but it was the only thing that these executives could actually control and measure in some way. And it seems to me, if you're the deep triple C, you're sitting back in D's in Washington, and the only thing that you can measure is cash and sort of like the least amount of effort expended, you know, some type of unit of like every dollar that comes with only a certain amount of effort, right? And right. like that becomes the most important metric, because it's the only one that actually empowers you sitting in Washington. I mean, as opposed right. to they have some type of ideological framework. Now, there may be a relationship between those two things. I think there is. But in the context of this, it just sounds like bad practice.
Right. And Zephyr, I believe, also thinks that there is some ideology underlying it, but you're right about her point. She's saying forget about the ideology for a second. Just look at it from a pure structural competence perspective. They don't have enough. They have a couple people looking at the entire Midwest. They have a couple people looking at the entire South. You know, a couple staffers looking at the Northeast. You know, how are a handful of people who have lots of other stuff to do? You know, they have press releases to write about what's going on in Congress at the moment and how they're going to take advantage of that. They have, you know, their own fundraising that they're doing for the organization more broadly. They've got tons of stuff going on. They have a tiny amount of energy that they can put into who is the better candidate in Minnesota's second district. And they look and they say, well, Angie Craig raised $5 million. She almost won in 2016. She only lost by 7,000 votes. She wants to run again. Let's do it. Check the box and move on to your next task. And Zephyr's point is that kind of investment in the process is just going to create, it's going to make mistakes. You're not going to make the right calls. You would need many times more amount of resources, and you still, because it's so complex, who knows who the best candidate is necessarily going to be. That's why we are supposed to have elections.
Right. And so, okay, so there is that element of just like, this is just a bad way to run a business almost, right? Like, it's just like, you can't intervene at that level and have, almost the best you can do is like the inevitable outcome anyways. And more often than not, you get a worse outcome.
Right. A great example would be in Pennsylvania in the Senate race in 2016. If you remember,
yes.
There was that guy Fetterman who shocked everybody by doing quite well in the primary. He was that 6'6" biker populist guy.
Yep.
And then you had Sestak, who had been running and working the state and organizing for 4 years or so, getting ready for this race. But Ed Rendell in particular and the party in general hated him because he had gone against the deal that they had made with Arlen Specter, and he had primaried Specter and knocked Specter out and lost in the general election. He was headed towards winning the primary, and the party jumped in and got behind Katie McGinty, who, for whatever reason, they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars. Emily's List jumped in and spent $3 or $4 million to push her through the primary. But the argument on the tactical level would be, if your candidate's so good, she shouldn't need millions of party dollars to win the primary. That might suggest that she's not the strongest candidate and will lose in the general election. And sure enough, she got smoked in the general election and lost worse than Hillary Clinton did. And most people that I talk to in Pennsylvania think that there's a very good chance Sestak, with the grassroots organizing he's been doing over the years, would have won Pennsylvania. And had he won Pennsylvania, you know, would he have pulled in enough votes to flip it for Hillary? It is impossible to say.
Right.
But it would have changed the dynamics.
And that's an instance on some level that may be just sort of like personal animus, you know what
right.
I mean? Or just, you know, not even sort of like a, you know, some type of formula. And then the other aspect of this, it seems to me, and I want to get to the ideological aspect, but the other aspect, I think it was, Lynch. He said in your piece that Democrats and Republican parties are commercial enterprises. And this also reminds me of my experience at Air America, where it was just like you had these failed radio executives who came in and they had access. At one point, we were going to have like Blue State Digital before it was Blue State Digital had offered to like geo-target exactly people who would be like a one-to-one yield on for a mailer as to who would be an Air America listener, right? And you're telling these radio executive people, and they're like, nah, I'm just going to go with the guy I used to use for contests on this Spanish radio station I did. And the reason why they're doing that is because they're going to use the company money to pay a buddy of theirs so that when they're out of a job, their buddy's going to help them out. And it sort of feels like there's a huge element like that that's in play here, too.
Right. And that goes back to your other point of whether what people are looking out for, whether it's the organization, the party or their own interests. And, you know, human nature, you know, you got kids, you look out for your own interests. Like that's how people operate. And so Steve Lynch's argument, he's a congressman from Massachusetts. So it's a commercial enterprise, and what he meant by that was that it is built and, you know, reproduces itself to feed the ecosystem of consultants who make their livings off of campaigns. You know, you have consultants who do mail, some that do email, you have some that do TV ads, and you have some that nobody has any idea what they do, but they dial into conference calls and they get significant, you know, retainers for every month of advice that they give to these candidates. And a lot of these are novice candidates who are just taking the advice of the DCCC and who they should hire. And DCCC will give you a list. Here are our recommended consultants. And if you're a candidate, you are going to take the DCCC's recommendations awfully seriously. A, you might think they know what they're doing, but B, you want the DCCC to like you because you are always believing that they're going to come in and pump millions of dollars into your race. So, you know, even if you might disagree with what the DCCC is telling you, you're thinking, well, I'm going to go along here with this and go along with that, so that, you know, come September, you know, they're going to come in and tell me that they're dropping $4 million on television ads.
Right.
And, you know, they often don't, but that's the hope that these candidates have. So they pump money to these consultants. You know, so if you raise $5 million and you drop, you know, a couple million of that on consultants, and it, you know, to place a TV ad, they charge about 15%. And so to say, I want to put a TV ad in the Chicago metro area. If you do a million, you know, 150,000 of that goes to the consultant just to place the ad, which is a lucrative way to live your life. Karl Rove actually made it his mission to nudge that 15% down to 2 or 3% among Republican consultants, because he said it was an existential issue for them. They were just burning through so much money just that was going to pay for, you know, the private schooling of Republican consultants. And so they've been able to squeeze. The Republicans have been able to squeeze their consultants more because Rove made it a strategic priority, whereas the Democrats have not been as successful at that. And so, right, so you wind up having incentives to go with the candidate who has shown an ability to raise a bunch of independent money, because that money is going to go to consultants. And the nickname for E-Trip in Washington is the consultant factory. You know, after you do a couple years there, you go out and set up your own firm. You call it, you know, winning victory strategies. you get on the DCCC's list and make the money.
Incidentally, I would also add, that is exactly the model. I don't know if it still exists this way, but that's exactly the model with sitcoms, right? You know, like you're working at the studio, you're working for Disney Studios, and you're an executive there for 3 or 4 years, and then you go off and you become an independent producer. You sign a deal with Disney Studios. I mean, that's how we got shit like According to Jim. With Jim Belushi. I mean, that is exactly how that show got on and was on for 5 or 6 years. And everybody made a ton of money, and it was a shit show. I mean, and so there's that element of this. And what's also interesting.
But it makes sense. It has its own internal logic all the way through.
Of course, because you have a bunch of individuals who are looking out for their own best, you know, their own incentive structure, and there's nothing offsetting it in any way. I wouldn't be surprised if there were either direct kickbacks to those from those consultants, or at the very least sideways kickbacks, right? Like down the road incentive structures. But.
Well, the down the road incentive structure is the one you laid out. Like, if you need help setting up your firm, or you want to become a partner at our firm when you're finished toiling as Midwest political director, you can come work for Winning Target Strategies.
Of course. And here's the thing is that, A, the Democrats don't have a Karl Rove figure who is willing to shut the barn door, essentially, after after he gets out. But there's also a difference insofar as the Republican Party, relative to the outside groups now, has a much different dynamic. You know, you can talk about the DCCC versus, let's say, you know, Our Revolution or Justice Democrats or, you know, People's House Project. And the money dynamic is nowhere relative to what the Republican Party is to, say, the Americans for Prosperity or the Koch brothers networks. Right. I mean, that's a big difference structurally.
Right. And the Kochs also, and they pride themselves more than Democrats do as people in their understanding of business. And so the Kochs did the same thing. They were like, we're not paying this 15% ripoff fee. We're going to figure out ways to get this down. But you're right there. You have a much bigger amount of money sloshing around the Republican side.
And I would think that from an ideological perspective, like the measurement of dollars being more important than the people you have on the ground, and the assessment of like what will appeal to people in the general, that's where ideology comes in, right? I mean, it's almost like,
it's become self-fulfilling. Yeah,
right.
It's like who can raise more money, the teacher or the medical device executives. And even if you started out politically the same as you graduated from college, if you spent 27 years, being a union teacher, and coaching football and being part of your, this middle-class community, you've formed a certain, politics over those decades. If you, spent your time in the C-suite flying first class, where your friends, all their children go to private school. You live in a much nicer neighborhood. You have different concerns, and the issues that you think about are just different. So even if your politics started the same, you just, by living in different worlds and having different friends and relationships, you end up being a different person politically. And so the people who can quickly raise a couple $100,000 from their network of friends and associates tend to be the kinds of people that have been around money, and that tends to shift your politics.
So what is, how much of this reporting, your reporting, and how much sort of like self-examination at the DCCC, is there any change that's going on, A? And B, is it even possible but for a house cleaning? It just seems like this is like an operation. It's an enterprise that, you know, I think there's a certain amount of ideology involved in it, but it's just like, it's just a bad enterprise. It's just like attracting people who are not entrepreneurial, who are not thinking other than with a very narrow set of metrics, ones that are much easier and safer for them to use. They're trying to protect their jobs. So in some ways you can't go to funders and say, oh yeah, no, we don't intervene in primaries. Yeah, we don't do that. It's like basically saying like, hey, you should cut my pay by 15% or something. Like, you know, right? I mean, that's like what we're watching here is in some ways so banal, but it seems more problematic because for a lot of people, politics are more important than what you would see in the structure of like some marketing department at a long-time blue-chip company or something.
Yeah, I think there is actually a lot of hope. I don't think that they're necessarily going to be reasoned with, but I do think that they can be beaten and or a parallel structure can successfully be built. And actually, there was a one moment that signifies this for me in the last week. Tim Tegaris left Revolution Messaging, which was the kind of PR consulting firm that worked on Bernie's campaign. And he left to form his own consulting shop. And when he did, it was news in Politico Playbook, the kind of newsletter for Washington. And what this tells young people just getting into politics is that there is now a new career path for you. You know, there used to be one career path. It was, you know, win a couple or work on a couple of small campaigns, work your way up, maybe do a congressional campaign, you know, impress people, get to know the right people, you know, get into the DCCC, DNC, DSCC, and then go from there and become a consultant that replicates the strategies that you learned along the way. But what Tegaris, for instance, shows is that you can actually work on progressive campaigns, then you can do a consulting firm that works for an anti-establishment candidate like Sanders that impresses people, and by impressing you, you build up clients, and then you have enough cachet. You go out and do your own consulting firm. That's a parallel structure that that exists completely independent of the party structure. And as smart people see that there's a way to having a career in politics that doesn't require you to go through the DCCC, then that starts to change the incentive structure. Then if these candidates continue to, these progressive insurgent candidates continue to outraise their establishment opponents, you're going to see smart consultants who say, oh, this is actually a path forward. Not only can they win, but I can figure out a way to make money off of this. And that is when you will start to see the whole political economy change. It might still be a racket in some ways, but at least the donors who are fueling the racket will be millions of grassroots.
Are you there, Ryan?
Sorry. I'm here. You'd have millions of grassroots people who are your donor base, and so the party would have to orient itself politically to make those people happy and energized rather than orienting itself towards the current donor class.
I mean, that's right. And we should tell people, like, Tim Tegaris was, I can't remember what role he had on the Ned Lamont campaign, but it was big. And Ned Lamont, of course, was
right.
A big challenger to Lieberman. I mean, what's interesting about this question that you delved into is that on one level, it speaks to a change ideologically that is taking place in the Democratic Party. But on another level, like, these are the arguments that, you know, that even like Marcos Melitzis was having with the Democratic Party 10, 12 years ago, 14 years ago, that, I mean, you know, the notion and Melitzis, I would put, you know, ideologically, not necessarily on the vanguard of the far left, but the critique of the Democratic Party, the critique of, you know, the way that of media buying fees, about the structures. That is like a 15-year-old critique. It just seems like it's getting more exposed now, in part because the Democratic Party has been so decimated on these races, but also I think because there's also an ideological perspective on this as well.
Right, and there's a lot more young people. Millennials is a bigger generation, and you know they're moving into politics, and they're much more interested in the idea of backing an individual candidate who they believe in than they are supporting an institution. So partly, you know, it's coming at the same time that you're seeing that trend unfold. But you're right. I think technology has something to do with it too. You know, when the blogosphere was driving the Ned Lamont surge, you know, that was an important element. But without social media, the way it exists now, it was much more difficult to move it. So now these insurgent candidates have a sophisticated understanding of how to use email and also social media, which enables them to get their message out in a way that was more difficult 10 or 15 years ago. And then you have the base that's more receptive to it.
It's interesting. You know, there was a response in The Intercept to your piece by Paul Perry, who ran in Pennsylvania's 7th District. I guess it just dropped out. In this 2018 cycle. And there was a line he had in there, like, this is how we train our leaders in this country, talking about the meetings that he had to go to sort of like, to appeal to the DCCC. And the more that there's other incentives, more that the more Tim Tegaris is, the more Justice Democrats, the more of these, People's House Projects, whatever it is, grow up around the DCCC, all of it changes on some level.
That's right. And particularly if they win, you have to win.
Right.
And we'll see. The fourth quarter of 2017 was awfully interesting. Maybe 8 or 9 of these insurgent candidates outraised establishment opponents. They don't just have to outraise them, though. They also have to beat them. But if you're winning the fundraising race with small dollars, that's a good sign that you have a good chance of winning. Because if somebody gave you money, they're probably going to go out and vote for you, and they're probably going to tell their friends to go out and vote for you, and they're more likely to go knock on doors. And in these primaries, you might have 20,000 or 30,000 people vote total in a Democratic primary. So, just bringing out 15,000 or 20,000 of your supporters gets you that win, but the left needs to win them. If it's just a bunch of smoke and fire on Twitter and Facebook, and then the candidates end up losing in the primaries, then the system that exists is just will continue to perpetuate itself. So look, Angie Gregg won,
right.
Although I think she will win. But there are many others that I think will lose.
It's also interesting, too, because you made the point in 2006 that Rahm Emanuel got credit for a lot of wins that were a function of a wave. And I remember that election very, very well. There was a lot of factors going on. It wasn't just the anti-Iraq war sentiment. It was also literally like corruption to the level where they were protecting, what was a guy who was perceived as being a child sex predator. Like they were
right.
actively protecting
it. Right.
I'm not talking about Denny Hastert, who they also right. apparently now we have a better sense of what was going on, maybe. But Rahm Emanuel got a lot of credit for that. And on closer inspection, he didn't deserve it. In fact, he lost races probably that we could have won. And in this instance, though, it cuts the other way. If the left can win these primaries and then take advantage of the wave, then there's going to be a lot of credit there. And lastly, and I know you got to go, but just talk a little bit about Michael Podzor. He's the political director from the AFL-CIO, and he has a theory about what's going to be happening with elections going forward and how the Democratic Party should reorient itself in terms of perceiving what you want to do, like the building of long-term majorities versus the building of long-term policy wins.
Right. The idea is to think about politics as a means toward making people's lives better, which is kind of a radical shift in Washington. But the idea is that with so much anger out there about inequality and everything else that has fueled wave after wave, starting in 2006 and then culminating with the election of Donald Trump, the idea is that the old goal of a permanent majority, and by permanent you might mean 10 or 20 or 30 years, should no longer be the goal, because it's just simply not attainable. Nobody's gonna have a 20-year majority in a country where people are furious about everything. No matter how good you are, you're gonna get tossed out. So the idea then is that when you get into office, you should be ready to implement and execute on in a very bold agenda that's going to be popular, in the sense that it can't be undone when you're wiped out 2 years later. And you have 4 years, because if you have the White House, then you can block the new majority from undoing what you did. The two models would be the tax cuts that the Republicans just jammed through. They may lose the House, but they're going to be able to hold on to those tax cuts at least as long as Trump is president, and probably they'll hold on to a significant portion of it for longer than that. And even Obamacare, they've been able to knock out the less popular parts of it, the taxes, the mandates. But even running for 7 years on the idea that they're going to repeal Obamacare, they couldn't get rid of it because there are concrete benefits that people feel. So the idea is get a progressive Democratic majority in there that makes big steps forward, and then be prepared to get wiped out because people are angry. But when you get wiped out, you will have, let's say, put in place Medicare for all. You did a free college or whatever you did. You're going to be able to defend it from the minority because it's so popular. And then when you get back into power, be ready to, be ready to advance it further. So that's his idea of how to think differently about what's possible with legislative majorities than just simply saying, okay, well, let's figure out a way that we can just have a permanent majority.
Ryan Grimm, the piece is The Dead Enders. Candidates who signed up to battle Donald Trump must get past the Democratic Party first. It's in The Intercept. We will link to it. As always, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. We're going to head to the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. Every day we strive to give you high quality audio and, I guess, video entertainment in a certain sense. It is our members who support that endeavor. And as our way of saying thank you, we give you even more content, sometimes funny things, sometimes highly informative things, sometimes sad things.
Sometimes quasi-informative.
Sometimes, frankly, it's mediocre. It's not always, like, they all can't be gems.
No, especially the literal amount of hours we do.
Yeah, of course. But every day we try. So if you have the means, please become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. That's jointhemajorityreport.com. It is literally pennies a day. Now, it's like 25 to 50 pennies a day, but do you really want that many pennies? I mean, if you were stuck, can you imagine? God. So think of it as more like a get rid of your pennies service. Also, don't forget, today is Tuesday, and you know what that means. TMBS, right?
Correct.
And who's going to be on TMBS tonight?
We are going to have on a woman named Crystal Quaid, who's a political organizer and left Democratic activist in Missouri. And that's going to be sort of like on the ground dealing with some of the stuff that Grimm was talking about. And then Felix Biederman from Chapo Trap House is coming in. And we're going to compare Obama impressions and mock Bill Maher and do a lot of
other
stuff.
Well, also Megan McArdle, I assume.
And Megan McArdle is going to be.
Megan McArdle's going to be on the show today.
Squad.
Yes, exactly. She's going to be on the show. It was really hard living in my parents' house.
Kyle writing blogs.
It taught me to be resilient. Now here's why we shouldn't have sprinklers in people's apartment buildings. I am a sociopath robot.
Kyle sent me a like an IM like on our Slack. Kyle, our chief technological officer.
Chief technical innovator. Yes, and, he is literally our CTO.
He's he said, "Oh, you got to read this this article. It's great." And it was like a Megan McArdle, like 12, like it was sort of like what do you call it? Aphorisms. It was sort of like 12 aphorisms. And I was like, "Oh, yeah, it's." It was good. And he's the CTO, so like you got to give a wide berth for the CTO. And I was like, "Yeah, that's pretty good." You know, she's sort of like a right wing fanatic, but that was that was a good read. And he goes, "Dude, I was joking."
I like the way he does this. He's like, "Dude, you idiot!"
No, well,
I'm
imposing the way I would say it because that's like something that I would do. But
it's a good hate read.
Yeah, I mean, there was one or
See,
two
I
things.
See, I like Megan
that
McArdle.
I thought there was
she writes sentences. I thought can't really argue with that.
I thought there was one or two things that were like, you know, nice. Like I can't remember what it was. Like appreciate, you know, your letter carrier. I do. I mean, it was something like that. I mean, it was probably not as
it was also things like don't spend your raises.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
Which is easier for some people than others.
Right.
I enjoy the hell out of her.
Right. So there it is. And don't forget, you can check out Jamie's writings at Jamie Peck or patreon.com/JamiePeck.
Yeah. I published a piece last week that I hope everybody reads. It's about the backlash to Me Too and sort of build a taxonomy of the different responses and show... Spoiler alert, how socialist feminism is the only way forward.
There you go, folks. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. All right, going to take a quick break. Be right back.